From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The president met with Republican congressional leaders today, trying to hammer out details for the next round of coronavirus relief funding. Democrats and Republicans have been battling over what the bill, which could cost at least another $1 trillion, should contain. Let's start the hour with NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. And Franco, lots going on today. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he wants a relief bill capped at $1 trillion. Democrats in the House have already passed a much more expansive $3 trillion bill. So what does the White House want?
Well, the White House, the president, wants a payroll tax cut. And, you know, the president has taken a really hard line on this, including saying on Fox News that he may not sign the next stimulus package if it doesn't include a payroll tax cut. Democrats oppose the idea. Republicans have also been kind of uneasy about this idea, but the president insists a lot of Republicans like it.
Okay, well, so House and Senate leaders on the same page?
Well, it seems they still have some work to do. You know, leaders want liability protections for business. And, you know, this could all be part of a negotiating tactic, including within the party. But as NPR's Ron Elving has explained, it's either going to be a three-way compromise with Democrats, Republicans, and the White House, or it's going to be a three-way standoff.
Okay. The president also said today that he's going to bring back his regular 5 p.m. coronavirus briefings. Did he say why?
Well, that's certainly the big news of the morning. President Trump kind of talked about it, and he even talked about how popular they were. You know, it's a clear recognition of the rising cases and concerns about those cases of coronavirus. And the administration also seems to know that it needs to tackle this more directly, especially after Trump has been kind of downplaying the spikes in cases nationwide.
Yeah, well, he did that in his interview with Chris Wallace of Fox News Sunday. He downplayed the threat of COVID-19 and had this to say about a nationwide masks mandate.
I don't agree with the statement that if everybody wear a mask, everything disappears. Hey, Dr. Fauci said don't wear a mask. Our Surgeon General, terrific guy, said don't wear a mask. Everybody was saying don't wear a mask. All of a sudden, everybody's got to wear a mask. And as you know, masks cause problems, too. With that being said, I'm a believer in masks. I think masks are good. But I leave it up to the governors.
So a little spinning there by Franco, President Trump referring when he said, you know, people said don't wear masks. That was early guidance because there was a fear there wouldn't be enough for first responders. It's long been proven to be effective in stopping the spread. There has long been, you know, all sorts of different sources of masks. So now the president has left policy up to the states, as he said it should be up to the governors. Talk about that strategy.
You know, again, cases are on the rise. As you point out, that was early guidance, and it's pretty clear among health officials and scientists are indicating, all showing that the benefits of wearing a mask and how it's one of the leading ways to clamp down on the spread of this virus. You know, the fact that the president has not embraced that has led to some blowback against the administration. And there have even been some internal battles, including members of the White House publicly criticizing Dr. Anthony Fauci, who, you know, as you note, is a member of the coronavirus task force and who is extremely well trusted in the United States. So it's not a good look right now.
Yeah. Let's listen to a little more of that interview with Chris Wallace. President Trump had this to say when asked if the Confederate flag is racist.
It depends on who you're talking about, when you're talking about. When people proudly had their Confederate flags, they're not talking about racism. They love their flag. It represents the South. They like the South. People right now like the South. I say it's freedom of many things, but it's freedom of speech.
Franco, Maggie Haberman had a piece in the Times this weekend saying that this is the way the president thinks people in the South want him to speak, even as states like Mississippi are getting rid of symbols of the flag. Who do you think the president is trying to appeal to here?
I mean, certainly there is a faction of his base that President Trump feels needs to hear these words from him. He's continuing to push back on efforts to remove Confederate symbols. You know, he's continued to kind of create distinct lines between some of the groups that are calling for the removal of these symbols, and demonstrating in U.S. cities. You know, Trump has also taken on organizations like NASCAR that have banned the Confederate flag, charging it's against freedom of speech. And He just does not seem to be backing down. And I think this will continue to be a major issue.
Well, by the way, Franco, some people would say those symbols are symptoms. And we will leave it at that. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez, thank you.
Thank you so much.
A new study from South Korea shows that older children, those between the ages of 10 and 19, can spread the coronavirus as effectively as adults can. The information may help inform officials and how they're thinking about how to begin school in the fall and whether to open schools for in-person learning. Joining us now with more on this study is Jeffrey Shaman, who is a professor of environmental health sciences at Columbia University. And Jeffrey, can you tell us more about this study and its findings?
Well, what the study did is it analyzed the reports from over 59,000 contact tracings that were performed based off of about 5,700 what are called index cases in Korea. So Korea has a very extensive testing and tracing program. And what they would do when they would find somebody positive, that person, if they hadn't been found through tracing, if they had just come in and been swabbed because they weren't feeling well, and they turned out positive, they would be called an index case. They include a whole age range. It includes children, very young children, 0 to 9-year-olds, all the way up to elderly people over 80 years of age. And they show how much these individuals are suspected of having spread the virus. They had a couple interesting findings in this. Firstly, there's a lot more transmission in the household than outside the household. That's not unexpected. But what they also saw was that for children who were 10 to 19 years old, they seem to be just as likely to transmit the virus to other people as adults do. And there's been a lot of discussion in the media lately, and certainly in the scientific literature, as to whether or not children are as involved in the transmission cycle and as capable of passing right. the virus on to others. And this provides evidence that they are.
Yeah, this is the most extensive study to date. Do we know why younger children don't seem to spread the virus as much as older children do? What's the difference there between those two populations?
The short answer is we don't know. We're still learning so much about this virus, unfortunately. It's been plunked into our midst, and we're scrambling to get as much information about it. They didn't have a lot of index patients, these initial infections from which they did the tracing, who were in the lowest age bracket. They only had 29 of them. And it's indicative that they're not getting as severely symptomatic. They're less likely to go in and actually be swabbed and actually seek medical attention. So they were less likely to be established as an index case.
That's interesting, because then that brings for me the question on whether children over 10 were usually asymptomatic or had they already been diagnosed with COVID-19.
Well, that's it. I mean, the thinking is, and it's hard to tell because we don't have a complete picture of all the undocumented infections. We only know those who come in and seek clinical care. What we see in COVID-19 is that adults are the preponderance of people who are coming in and being tested and not feeling well, who are doing it for symptomatic reasons. So severe disease manifests in the elderly, but there is a lot of infection that has symptoms and causes people to seek medical attention among those in the age bracket from 20 to 50. But when you get below 20, there's a big drop off in the number who are actually seeking clinical care because of symptoms related to a COVID-19 infection. So what it means is that there may be a lot of very mild and asymptomatic infection in children. But the question is, are they capable of actually passing it on to other people? This big study actually provides more evidence to suggest that certainly within the 10 to 19-year-old bracket, these children are capable of transmitting the virus.
This is all very important right now because schools across the country are really trying to decide whether or not to open up in the fall. Many have already decided not to. What does this study mean for plans to reopen schools in the fall? Should there be, from your view, in-person learning based on this information that we're just now receiving?
It's a very complicated issue. Bringing people together, that includes children and teachers together in school, is a daily mass gathering of people that provides opportunities for transmission. On the other hand, we have these competing interests. Education is very important, particularly in formative years. It's very important for younger children to be in school. It's a very critical time in their development. So we can't just say that the disease is paramount and we have to only consider that. So the question is, can we do it safely? Can we actually bubble our children enough so that they're in small groups that don't mix with each other, so that social distancing is adhered to, face masks are used, so that we can keep the environment as safe as possible. So the bottom line is that if we're going to do this, we have to do it very carefully with a lot of controls in place. We have to understand that if we do it in communities where there is a high infectious rate, where we don't have the virus under control, that is particularly problematic. We have to get the case rate down in this country considerably in order to really think about education as a safe proposition in school.
That's Jeffrey Shaiman. He's a professor of environmental health sciences at Columbia University. Jeffrey, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Bard College at Simon's Rock, where students who crave intellectual freedom can begin college after the 10th or 11th grade. Bard College at Simon's Rock unleashes students' curiosity through a rigorous liberal arts and sciences curriculum and puts them on track toward completing a bachelor's degree 1 or 2 years early. Now accepting applications for fall 2020. simons-rock.edu/now. Where independent minds get their start.
In a Fox News Sunday interview with Chris Wallace, President Trump made this comment when asked about public school education.
Now they want to change. 1492, Columbus discovered America. You know, we grew up, you grew up, we all did. That's what we learned. Now they want to make it the 1619 Project. Where did that come from? What does it represent? I don't even know.
It's so, slavery.
That's what they're saying, but they don't even know.
As many throughout the country are aware, the 1619 Project was a landmark issue in the New York Times Magazine, created by Nicole Hannah-Jones, a reporter who covers racial justice for the Times. It refers to the year that the first enslaved people were brought to America and looks at how slavery continues to shape every aspect of American culture. When it was published last August, the magazine created a sensation, something I spoke with Hannah-Jones about last September. We'll link you at hereandnow.org. In May, the 1619 Project won a Pulitzer Prize, and now Oprah Winfrey and Lionsgate have teamed up with Hannah-Jones to bring the work to an even wider audience through multiple platforms. Last week, I spoke with Nicole Hannah-Jones about the 1619 Project and how it continues to resonate during the current Black Lives Matter movement. So when we spoke last fall, you had just received a message that parents in New Jersey were taking your work to schools and demanding it be taught as part of the history curriculum. And now we're seeing entire curriculums and programming jump started because of your work. Do you see your work as one of the many defining moments that actually led us to this moment of reckoning?
I would not have the hubris to say that my work has led to this moment. I do think that the contribution the 1619 Project has made is that it certainly contributed to the lexicon around how we got here. I think it has allowed many Americans, particularly white Americans, to connect dots that they weren't connecting before, that this police violence and the inequality, that these aren't just unrelated incidents, but have a long and deep legacy that has to be confronted. And to the extent that has helped drive people out into the streets where maybe they would have sat home or on the sidelines before, or wouldn't have considered this to be a widespread long-term injustice that needs to be rectified, I can't say, but I'm certainly grateful for any role that the project might have played in that.
Mm-hmm. There are plans to make the 1619 Project into a TV show, documentary films, and books. And as I mentioned, it will become part of the curriculum for school districts in places like Chicago and Washington, D.C. and Buffalo, New York. This really speaks to the yearning that those parents in New Jersey and other places have been asking for. I want to ask you, though, about this larger push that has been underway for many, many years about textbooks that American children are learning from. The accuracy of those textbooks has been under scrutiny for some time. Do you see this work as moving forward in the effort to get a fuller view of American history?
Absolutely. We know that the way that history is taught in American schools is highly politicized. And it really has a nationalistic agenda. We're taught a history that speaks to American exceptionalism, to American progress. And so because of that, because our history curriculum in K-12 is largely trying to shape a shared national identity, what that has meant is it is necessarily downplayed the role of slavery, the genocide and theft of land from indigenous people, and all of the ways that America has not lived up to those ideals of exceptionalism. That has robbed Americans of the ability to properly assess their country and why things are like they are. And what the 1619 Project does is it offers a counter to that narrative and really tries to flesh that out and challenge that narrative in ways that I hope will lead people to question a lot of narratives. You know, there could be a 1619-like project about indigenous peoples. There are many different stories that really need to be told so that we could have a fuller version of the American project, and not just one that seeks to glorify us, but really one that seeks to challenge us.
Your most recent work, titled What is Owed, takes on the case for reparations for Black Americans. And in it, you cite a study that found that 71% of white Americans believe racial and ethnic discrimination is wrong. Just a few years ago, a little more than half of white Americans reported feeling that way. Do you believe there is an appetite for reparations?
I don't think that there is enough of an appetite for it right now. I just was looking at some polling on this yesterday, and it showed amongst white Democrats, so, you know, the party that the vast majority of Black Americans vote for, that only about 30% of white Democrats support the idea of reparations. So clearly there's a lot of work to do on that. But at the same time, I think, again, it's related to the work of the 1619 Project. There's such a visceral response that many white Americans have to the idea of reparations. And I think that's really based on the fact that they actually have no understanding of this history. They have no understanding of the singularity of Black suffering, of the dragnet of laws and policies that have created the generational disadvantage that Black Americans face. And part of what I try to do with my piece on What is Owed is really lay that history out and really show that there's nothing that Black Americans can do on our own to erase a 350-year system of racial segregation and economic exploitation. So no, we're not ready for that yet. But part of the work that I'm doing and that so many others are doing is trying to move that conversation forward so that we can maybe get to the point where we can be serious about addressing that. And we have seen movement. So when you look at the fact that in the presidential or the primary debates, the Democratic primary debates, reparations was treated as a serious question by journalists and by people on that stage. 5 years ago, you wouldn't have seen that. When you look at H.R. 40, which is the bill to study the issue of reparations, it's been introduced every year for 30 years and has never made it out of committee. But a few years ago, it had just three co-sponsors. Now it has well over 100 co-sponsors. So we are seeing some traction. And like many things when it comes to racial justice, it's a decades-long struggle, not a months or years-long struggle.
Mm-hmm. You're a Black journalist covering racial justice issues for The New York Times at a time when news organizations are being forced to reexamine racism in newsrooms and really the marginalization of Black journalists and the flawed narrative that somehow journalists of color should separate one's identity from reporting. Do you see newsrooms evolving from this? Because there is an argument that is still being had in many newsrooms about objectivity, neutrality, and where journalists of color sit in that paradigm.
Yeah, I think there is a reckoning happening right now. And of course, when you are a Black journalist, you've never bought into this idea that your identity is unrelated to your coverage. And we've known that that's not true for ourselves. And we've certainly known that that's not true for white journalists either. Of course, a white journalist's identity in a white-dominated society plays a role in how they cover stories, what they choose to cover, and what they don't. So it's always been interesting to me that our role as journalists is to explain the world to itself. And so here we are reporting on these national reckonings, racial reckonings happening across all of these different institutions and all of these different organizations and private companies. Yet we don't fully understand this ourselves, and we have not dealt mm-hmm. with these issues ourselves. So how can we explain to the world that which we don't fully understand? So I think this is a very interesting time that we're in, where Black journalists are speaking out and are really pushing our news organizations in a public way, which is more unusual. And I hope that the only reckoning that comes out of this time of protest, that it also comes to our industry as well. If we see ourselves as really the linchpin, as the free press, as a linchpin of democracy, then we have to democratize our own institutions.
Are you hopeful or optimistic?
No. No, I'm not. I think I'm realistic. And realistically, if you study history, then you know that massive transformation is very rare and only comes after very sustained periods of resistance. And then it never fully transforms society and is often faced by a backlash and a retrenchment. So I'm already looking at how little news coverage the protests are getting, how little coverage we're seeing in media around if there's actually going to be police reforms or not. We're already seeing this narrative because of a rise in shootings that, you know, we can't defund police because look at all this violence in these communities. So I think that what we're fighting against is so deeply entrenched that it's hard to be hopeful that we're going to see that real necessary transformation. With that said, I am hopeful that people will keep fighting, because even if we don't think that we're going to see that, we are, I think, obligated to fight for it.
Nicole Hannah-Jones is the Pulitzer Prize-winning creator of the New York Times 1619 Project, which is being developed for multiple projects in conjunction with Oprah Winfrey and Lionsgate. Nicole Hannah-Jones, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
And for tens of millions of Americans who lost their jobs because of the pandemic, the clock is ticking on that extra $600 in weekly federal unemployment benefits they've collected through the CARES Act. Now, some Republican leaders say that's now a disincentive. It keeps people from going back to work. But those who support Congress extending it by the end of the month next week say it was a great boost to the economy, and many workers can't go back yet. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money, has been looking at this all. So, Jill, this $600 payment adds up to about $15 billion a week that the federal government is putting in people's pockets. Did you see it help the economy?
Oh, it absolutely did. In fact, we know from the past, but also in the pandemic, that those who earn less money and receive some sort of government help tend to recycle those dollars, spend those dollars in the economy. And you might compare that with, say, somebody who got a stimulus check early on, but maybe the household didn't really lose income. Those people actually just save the checks, which is good for the family, not so good for the economy.
Well, but are some of the Republicans who are saying, well, wait a second, this is now a disincentive, because why would somebody go back to work for $600 less a week? And we did hear stories about employers who either couldn't get employees to come back when they did start opening back up, or were loath to ask them to give up that extra unemployment money for a shaky job, you know, when lockdown restrictions started to be lifted. You know, so are some of these Republican lawmakers correct that it became a disincentive for people going back to work?
Well, I don't know if it's a disincentive, but it's clear that we have some analysis from the University of Chicago. It found that about two-thirds of the people receiving those extra unemployment checks, two-thirds of them actually were making more unemployment than they were working prior. Now, that was a strange, I think, an outcome of Congress trying to get money out fast. They basically said, what's median household income in the United States? They applied it out, and it turned out to be $600 a week. What we didn't know at that time was that the pandemic would really hit low-income workers much harder than middle and higher earners. But that said, look, there's 32 million people who are collecting unemployment benefits right now. The disincentive is no one's hiring, so it's really hard to get a job.
Right, right. And by the way, also at the time this was, came up with this plan, they were trying to keep people home from work. They were giving them an incentive to stay home from work because they were ordering places to lock down. Look, we've been reading about how COVID-19 has contributed to income inequality in the U.S. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, the Census Bureau has found that income inequality is basically at the highest level in 50 years. And, you know, I'm going to throw a few numbers out here at the top and at the bottom. Two-thirds of the total wealth in the U.S. is owned by the richest 5%. Meanwhile, if you look at the other end of the spectrum, about 40% of American adults said before the pandemic they'd have difficulty covering a $400 unexpected expense. We've got 38 million Americans living in poverty. 14 million children went hungry last month, and that is why it is essential that Congress get it together this week, because I think that there's going to be unnecessary suffering if we let this drag on.
Yeah. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News, host of Jill on Money, and when you say this week Congress is returning and the push is on to get that extension of the extra $600 a week in unemployment payments under the CARES Act. Jill, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
White evangelical Christians are among President Trump's biggest supporters. Over 80% voted for him in 2016. But according to new polling, that number has dropped to 72%. Evangelical voters are not a monolith, but they tend to agree on certain issues. So let's bring in one of the country's foremost evangelical leaders and an advisor to President Trump, Dr. Mike Evans. Welcome.
Delighted.
The president handed evangelicals two conservative Supreme Court justices, moved the American embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. So why do you think, given that, support is dropping?
I think it has a lot to do with the environment we're living in right now. I think there's a lot of people that are depressed, lost their jobs. They're looking at the race riot crisis. And a lot of that is upsetting them, rightfully so. Now, I can tell you this. I have 73 million Facebook followers on the Jerusalem prayer team. These are pro-Israel evangelicals, and they're very, very behind the president in his positions on Israel.
Well, we're going to get to that, but you called it race riots. Others are calling it a moment of racial reckoning. There's the pandemic. These are somber times. The president early on said COVID-19 was like a flu. It would disappear like a miracle. And polls show a devastating two-thirds of Americans don't trust what he says on this issue. And then again, to this moment of racial reckoning, the president has said he doesn't see anything wrong with the Confederate flag or statues to what others would call Civil War traitors. Do you see support wavering because of what's happening in this moment, the president's handling of these historic issues?
I can't speak to that. I can only tell you that my mother was an Orthodox Jew and my father was a professing Christian racist who I grew up hearing him say the Jews are running the country and the blacks are ruining it. I'm tolerant because of what I've experienced. I'm looking at the suffering of human beings, and they're suffering because of discrimination and pain, and I have compassion for them, and I have understanding because I suffered under the hands of a racist father who strangled me at 11 and left me for dead when I tried to defend my Jewish mother. So I hate racism.
Yeah.
And yet, you know that there are many Americans and many Black Americans who feel this president is racist.
I believe that Donald Trump is the greatest friend Israel's ever had. And here's what I think he's going to do. I think Donald Trump is going to surprise everybody, and he's going to declare sovereignty over Judea and Samaria and the Jordan Valley. And he's going to say the Bible is not illegal. And when he does that, the evangelical base will jump right up to 100%. They're worried about this country. When they see the riots, when they see the plague, when they see the destabilization, they wonder if God is unhappy with our nation. And they want God to bless our country. And one of the scriptures unites them is Genesis 12. I will bless them that bless thee and curse them that curse thee. So yeah. I think he's going to come out with that. And I think he's going to get an enormous support from the evangelicals.
It sounds like what you're saying is that your embrace of Israel, and let's talk about this now, overrides concerns that that other people have about the president being racist. You said, for instance, the Bible says, who blesses Israel? God blesses that person. You believe that Donald Trump understands that. Do you also believe that Donald Trump is part of biblical prophecy? We know many evangelicals see him as the modern day flawed, disbelieving pagan Cyrus, who was chosen by God in the Bible to work miracles. Today, many believe Trump has been chosen to play a role now. Do you?
You know, I'm not a prophecy person. I'm a journalist, and I have to deal with the facts. I've written 105 books and over 5,000 articles. I see Donald Trump as a flawed human being. I'm combating anti-Semitism. I believe Donald Trump is a great friend of the Jewish people in Israel. I don't believe Donald Trump is a perfect person. And by the way, we're all flawed. We're all human beings and make mistakes, and some make more than others.
But you well know that there is feeling that the prophecy is that a flawed character, and many believe that it is Donald Trump, much like Cyrus, will play a role in the end times and the return of Christ, which the Bible says will come after a huge battle between Iran and Israel. God will then intervene and save the believers in the rapture. I've really synopsized there a bit. But you know, John Hagee, Guillermo Maldonado preached this. Lance Wallnau and former televangelist Jim Baker sell a Trump-Cyrus coin that people can use to pray for Trump's reelection. Do you disavow all of that?
Listen, I've known a lot of presidents all the way back to Carter, and every one of them was flawed. Actually, to be honest with you, Ronald Reagan, when I would meet with him in private and when I'd see him in public, was two different people. He was not very friendly in private. He tended to be aloof. But in public, he was soft and charming. You know, I think one of the things evangelicals liked about Donald Trump, he was Donald Trump 24 hours a day. If you love him or don't love him, you knew you're getting the same guy.
Some Americans worry that evangelicals are embracing Donald Trump because he's seen to be this flawed biblical character, Cyrus, but also because Donald Trump may be willing to play a part in fulfilling this biblical prophecy in order to keep your votes, and therefore might execute foreign policy when it comes to Israel, not for the good of America, but for the good of end times.
I'm not in it to convert the Jews of Israel or usher in the Messiah. I'm in it to combat anti-Semitism. I can tell you a little story. I was having dinner with the chief rabbi of Moscow at the David Citadel Hotel the night Donald Trump won. And the chief rabbi said to me, Donald Trump's going to win. I said, how do you know that? He said, have you read the Haftorah this week? He said, the scripture reading is Abraham in Genesis 12, I will bless them that bless thee. He said, Donald Trump supports life, the right to life, and Israel, and God's going to give him the presidency. As the chief rabbi of Moscow, and it happened.
But this is also a man who mocks and bullies, lies, favors autocrats. Seems like the least, turn the other cheek, Jesus-like president we've ever had. Now, some can understand, yes, this is a man who has said he will try to get rid of Roe v. Wade, and as we said, has appointed conservative judges. And that's understandable. If that is a bedrock of belief, the number one thing somebody wants to vote for, one can understand why that would happen. But people have a harder time understanding, you know, somebody who would have peaceful protesters tear gas so that he could do a photo op with a Bible that he rarely opens. Some would say, why isn't an evangelical offended by a Bible as a photo op?
Well, let me take one point. As evangelicals, we have supported virtually every Republican president. And guess what? Every one of them told us the same things. They're going to recognize Jerusalem, and they're going to give us access. None of them gave us access. The only person that kept every promise he made to us was Donald Trump. He held the first state dinner in celebration evangelical leadership. Are you kidding me? I'll be honest with you. He's never broken his promise to us, we evangelicals.
It's been reported that he likes the idea that evangelicals think he was chosen by God. There are some who worry, again, that that's a dangerous thing for a person to think.
You know, the evangelicals in leadership, they're not voting for Donald Trump to be their pastor. And Donald Trump's not a perfect president. But I can tell you this, for the nation of Israel, there's never been a better president. I know that there's a lot of hurting people out there. There's Jewish people that are hurting. They've had their synagogues bombed. There's Black people that are hurting. And I don't want to do anything but have compassion and a hearing heart.
Oh, Mike Evans, you know, many people would say one of the sources of that suffering for people of color, especially, is Donald Trump.
I think that the problem with racism, it's easy. Texans, 25% of them believe Obama was born in Africa. That's nuts. But we've got to do our best, as Mother Teresa told me, to light a candle rather than curse the darkness.
Mike Evans, one of the country's foremost evangelical leaders and advisor to President Trump. Mike, Dr. Evans, thank you so much.
It was my honor. Thank you.
And of course, we have to note it was Donald Trump who spread that falsehood about Barack Obama's birth.
There are now more than 14.5 million coronavirus cases around the world, and more than 600,000 people have died during the pandemic. The United States has the highest death toll and the highest number of cases, but it's not the only country where coronavirus is surging. Jason Beaubien is NPR's global health and development correspondent. And Jason, besides the U.S., where else are you seeing big jumps in coronavirus numbers?
You know, unfortunately, it's in many parts of the world where numbers are going up. You're getting huge numbers of new infections in India and Russia. More than half of all the new cases are in the Americas overall, with Brazil and the U.S. really driving that. But also you're getting high numbers in Colombia, Chile, Peru, Mexico. And then you've got places like Hong Kong and Australia, which had looked like they were doing incredibly well. They'd gotten down to really low numbers, and now they're seeing outbreaks spring back up, and they're having to go back and reimpose lockdowns, closing schools, shutting down bars. The World Health Organization just had a press conference, and Mike Ryan, the head of emergencies for the WHO, he said they're very worried about the rapid increase in parts of Africa.
I think what we're starting to see is a continued acceleration of transmission in a number of countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And I think that has to be taken very, very seriously.
The worst in Africa at the moment is South Africa. They've got the largest outbreak on the continent. But Ryan also pointed out to about a half a dozen other countries where cases have increased more than 50% just over the last week. So in terms of hotspots, it's all over the globe, and those global numbers continue to march higher, and they're setting new daily records.
You touched on this, but are there any common threads in these countries, especially in places like India and Brazil, where the pandemic is really raging?
It is interesting. I mean, if you look at the top four countries, not counting the U.S., it's Brazil, Russia, India, and South Africa. These are all large, dynamic, emerging economies. These are countries that are sort of on the wealthier side of the developing world. They had good transportation infrastructure, which may have helped sort of move the virus around more. Also have decent healthcare systems. But you also have large populations in these countries of poor people mm-hmm. who really struggle to survive when they're ordered into a lockdown. And lockdowns just weren't manageable in a place like South Africa for extended periods of time. But the political approaches to the crisis in South Africa and Brazil have been completely different. So it is, you can't just say there's one answer to this. Unfortunately, the outcomes have been similar, even with different approaches in some of these countries.
What about places that are getting better?
So, you know, things are getting better in Europe. It's important to see that there can be light at the end of the tunnel. You know, the virus hasn't gone away entirely. It's still a threat. But if you look at like Italy, Spain, France, even Sweden, they're down to now just to a few hundred cases a day instead of 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 cases a day like they had earlier in March. And, you know, they're seeing the trend line in their daily cases going down, pointing towards zero, not like the United States where it just continues to go up and up. And then there's some other countries that have really aggressively kept from ever having major transmission at all. Places like Barbados, Rwanda, Lebanon.
Yeah, and we're hearing about places like Barbados. I guess there are some things that we probably could learn as we learn more about the ways that they're curbing this virus. That's Jason Beaubien. He's NPR's global health and development correspondent. Jason, as always, thank you.
It's great talking with you, Tanya.
Tributes continue to pour in for U.S. Representative John Lewis, but somehow what we say about him pales in comparison to his own words and deeds. In 2018, Lewis delivered the keynote speech at Boston University's commencement, and afterwards he spoke with WBUR's Bob Oakes. He spoke about his own journey and a message for young people fighting for justice.
When you see evil, when you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, you have a moral obligation to do something, to say something. When I was growing up in rural Alabama, and we asked questions of my mother and my father, my grandparents and great-grandparents, why those signs? They were saying, don't get in trouble. But I was inspired by Rosa Parks and Dr. King and others to get in what I call good trouble, necessary trouble.
I'm wondering, with your knowledge and experience today, if you had the luxury of being able to reach across time and whisper into the ear of the young John Lewis back then, what would you say to yourself about life ahead?
I would simply say, young John Lewis, don't give up. Don't give in. There's a brighter day coming. Push, press on, pick them up, and put them down.
March ahead.
March ahead. Because Dr. King said on one occasion, there's not anything more powerful than the marching feet of a determined people.
That's the late U.S. Representative John Lewis speaking with WBUR's Bob Oakes in 2018. He died on Friday at the age of 80. And Robin, you actually had a chance to interview John Lewis.
I did. What a, you know, just a lovely man after all. He, you know, where did he find the grace, you know, after all he went through?
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.